Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Berkeley City College. I see some new faces that I don't see around the college, so if this is your first time in our doors, welcome. Make sure you pick up a summer schedule or a fall schedule on your way out and come back and take a class with us.
What's the best class to take this summer?
This summer?
Laura's class.
Yeah, I'm not teaching, but my class it would have to be. we have many good classes. I just noticed a class I've never seen before, a sociology course, and sociology is not my background, on the culture of ethnic minorities, I believe it was called, and I thought, oh, that's great. I didn't know we taught that class here. That sounds fascinating. My name is Laura Roberto. I teach in the humanities program here at BCC, and my background is mostly on, I teach full studies, and my background is on immigration and cultural studies. And I participated in kind of organizing this series of writers and authors this semester, and this is our final final book in the series that we're presenting, and I was happy to have a kind of colleague and growing friend, James Tracy, who connected me to this book and seemed like the right thing to do and present here at Berkeley. And so I wanted to just introduce it a little bit and then pass the mic on to our three panelists. The book that we're presenting tonight, The Hidden 1970s, was edited by Dan Berger, who will be with us tonight, but is instead, we have three of the contributors to the volume here instead. And as I'm sure most of you here have a sense of already, the 1970s sometimes is sort of understood as the a decade where there was a lot of political apathy. That's sort of almost like a cliche or conventional thought about the decade or the youth and experiences of the decade after the vibrant political activism and radicalization of the 1960s. The 1970s often is seen to be this period of that sort of a lot of self-indulgence, a lot of narcissism, the so-called me generation with political apathy and also political conservatism. And in fact, as we all know and now have a nice book that presents it to us so clearly, it was a much more dynamic decade than that. And this collection uses the decade by reminding us of some of the multitude of critical action and radical politics associated with the 1970s. So tonight we have three contributors to the collection, Victoria Law, James Tracy, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who are each going to present part of the scholarship that they did in the collection. And I'll just introduce each of them now, and then I'll pass it on to them. Vicki Law is going to talk about the feminist responses to violence against women and domestic violence generally. And she's a writer, a photographer, and a mother. She's the editor of a zine called Tenacious, Art and Writings from Women in Prison, and the author of a new book called Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, which is also for sale at the front of the lockout. She's currently co-editing a collection called Don't Leave Your Friends Behind, an anthology about supporting parents and children in social justice movements. We also will have a presentation by James Tracy, who will be talking about working class movements of community empowerment in the 1970s. And James Tracy is a longtime social justice organizer nearby us here in San Francisco, and is the co-founder of the San Francisco Community Land Trust. He's been active in the Eviction Defense Network and the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. He's edited a number of handbooks, and he's also a poet, but he doesn't put that in his biography here, but I know him as a poet as well. One of his edited handbooks is called The Civil Disobedience Handbook, and another is called The Military Draft Handbook. He has a number of articles that appeared in places like Left Turn and Race Poverty and City Lights Foundation Anthology. He also has a co-authored book that's going to be coming out in the fall called Hillbilly Nationals, Urban Rebels, and Black Power. And our third speaker tonight is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who will be talking about indigenous struggles and movements in the 1970s. And she is another local participant in the collection tonight. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, and where she worked a lot in organizing. She's been involved in Native American sovereignty and land rights and the international indigenous movement since 1973. She's a historian and a writer and retired professor in Native American studies at California State University. She's authored many articles and books on indigenous issues, including the book entitled History of Land Tenure in New Mexico and Great Sioux Nation, as well as a memoir trilogy called Red Dirt, Growing Up Oki. So I'm very happy to have our three speakers with us tonight, and I will let them stay on the evening for us. Thank you.
All right, before I start, I just have a couple of quick questions. Just by a show of hands, how many of you have heard of Yvonne Wanroe? Inez Garcia? Joanne Little? Jenna Kelsey? Barbara Gilbert? Doesn't count if you've read my article already. Beverly Ibn Tomas? Kathy Thomas? All right. So I'm going to go through all of these cases and talk about how this idea of women's self-defense has gained currency in larger political movements, and also how the lack of attention paid to certain types of self-defense enabled the liberalization of the battered women's movement. So I'm going to start in 1972. In 1972, there was a woman named Yvonne Wanroe, who was a Colville Indian and a mother of two living in Spokane, Washington. That year, her 11-year-old son was grabbed from his bike by a man named William Wessler, who was a known child molester. Her son escaped and fled to the house of a family friend named Shirley Hooper. Earlier that year, Shirley Hooper's 7-year-old daughter had been raped and had contracted an STD as a result of the assault. When she saw William Wessler at her door, she told her mother, "That's the man that did that to me." Shirley Hooper called the police. And although they had arrested this man several times before for child molestation and were familiar enough with him to even nickname him Chicken Bill, they refused to do anything about it. Instead, they suggested to Hooper that she wait until after the weekend to file a complaint at the precinct. Hooper called Yvonne Wanroe, understandably shaken, and asked her to spend the night with her. Yvonne Wanroe, who was 5'4" and had recently broken her leg, brought her pistol along. At 5 a.m, Chicken Bill entered Hooper's home. He ignored the woman's demands that he leave. When Yvonne Wanroe went to the front door to yell for help, she turned around to find him towering over her. He was 6'2", and remember, she was 5'4" and had recently broken her leg. She shot and killed him. At her trial, the judge instructed the jury to only consider what had happened at or immediately before the killing. This omitted William Wessler's previous record as a sex offender, his assault on her friend's 7-year-old daughter, and his attempted assault on Yvonne's son. So the only thing they were allowed to consider was what had happened at the moment that she shot him. And she was convicted of murder and sentenced to 25 years. The story might have ended there, except that various groups and people involved in the women's movement and the American Indian movement took up her cause, and they recognized that a woman had the right to defend herself and her family from assault, and they saw this as a rallying point. They held events that raised awareness and educated people and tied her case into issues of violence against women and the systematic violence against Native people in the U.S. They also raised funds for her legal defense, which enabled her to appeal and get better legal representation than she would have otherwise as a single mom of two. In 1977, the Washington State Supreme Court granted her a new trial, partially on the basis that the jury should have considered all of the relevant facts when considering self-defense, not just what had happened at that immediate moment. And 2 years later, Yvonne Wanroe was granted a new trial. She pled guilty to reduced charges and received a suspended sentence, 5 years probation, and 1 year of community service. And this was a turning point in what we could consider women's self-defense cases in the 1970s. 2 years later, in California, there was a woman named Inez Garcia, also a mom, and a woman of color, who shot and killed the man who had helped her rapist assault her. She had been taken into an alleyway, and I'm sorry if this is triggering for some people, and the person that she shot blocked her way from escaping while she was assaulted by his friends. They then left her at her house and called her and threatened her some more, so she took her gun out and actually went looking for them and shot the man who had blocked her escape. She was arrested and charged with first degree or premeditated murder because she had gone out looking for them. And again, this might have ended, except that her cause was taken up by the women's movement. And they said, a woman has the right to defend herself against sexual assault, no matter what. And they organized teach-ins and fundraisers and galvanized popular support, using this idea that women had the right to defend themselves from rape. After her conviction, the women's movement continued to rally on her behalf and even hired a feminist attorney to take over her case. So again, they marshaled resources that alone Inez Garcia wouldn't have been able to have to get her better legal representation. 2 years later, in 1976, the California Court of Appeals reversed her conviction because the trial judge had instructed the jury not to consider the rape. And in the retrial, Susan Jordan challenged potential jurors about their preconceptions of rape. So she asked them, well, what do you think about rape? What would you do if somebody in your family had been raped, if your wife or your girlfriend or your sister or your daughter had been raped? And really challenged them around this idea that somehow women invite sexual assault. And this made the assault an integral part of the case from the get-go, whereas in the trial before that, the only thing that was being considered was what had happened at the time that she had shot her assailant. Garcia was acquitted, and the entire jury agreed that the rape and threat of future harm were adequate provocation for her shooting this man. Her acquittal established a legal precedent that extended the interpretation of imminent danger beyond the immediate time period and laid the groundwork for what became known as the battered women's defense, that a woman who kills her abuser is acting in self-defense even if she is not under attack at that time. That same year, in 1974, there was a 21-year-old black woman in North Carolina named Joanne Little. She was the only female prisoner in the North Carolina's jail. One day, the guards came in and they found a 62-year-old white male guard, Clarence Allegood, dead in Joanne Little's cell. He had been killed with an ice pick, he was missing his pants, and Joanne Little had fled. They determined after, they pieced together that Allegood had entered her cell, threatened Joanne Little with an ice pick, and forced her to perform oral sex on him. Then she stabbed him and fled, but turned herself in 8 days later after there was a manhunt for her. She was charged with first-degree murder, which in the state of North Carolina at the time carried a mandatory death sentence. Like the cases of Inez Garcia and Yvonne Wanro, there was a huge outpouring of support from various movements, including people and groups in the women's liberation and black liberation movements, as well as more mainstream feminists and other groups. And during her trial, and again, this resulted in teach-ins, fundraisers, and the ability to enable her to have better legal representation, including a team of outside experts and psychologists who were able to actually lay the case that she had been defending herself, and this wasn't just that she had stabbed somebody and fled. During her trial, Little's defense team exposed the fact that there was chronic sexual abuse and harassment endured by women in the jail and prison system throughout North Carolina. They countered the prosecution's argument that Little had somehow enticed Allegood into her cell with an ice pick and then had stabbed him. And the defense team called on women who had previously been held at the jail who testified that Allegood had a history of sexually abusing the women in his custody. One woman stated that he had fondled her while bringing her a late-night sandwich, and another recalled that he had suggested that he had been in jail long enough to need a man. Little herself testified that Allegood had come to her cell 3 times that night. After she refused his advances twice, he returned with an ice pick. By then, she said, I changed into my nightgown. He was telling me I really looked nice in my gown and he wanted to have sex with me. He said he had been nice to me and it was time I was nice to him. I told him I didn't feel like I should be nice to him that way. The jury deliberated for only 78 minutes and then acquitted her of murder, establishing a precedent for killing as a justified self-defense against rape. So what these three cases have in common is that the woman defended herself against assault or defended her family against assault, was arrested, and then groups rallied to their defense and enabled them to get better legal representation, enabled them to have more popular support, and basically enabled them to not spend the rest of their lives in prison. Now, looking at that same time period, there are groups of women who didn't get that same type of support, even though they too were defending themselves against assault and abuse. So in 1973, the year after Yvonne Wanro was first arrested, there was a woman named Jenna Kelsey who shot her and killed her ex-husband while he was beating her. And despite his history of abuse, including a nearly fatal incident in which he drove her car off the road with his truck, a jury found Jenna Kelsey guilty of second-degree murder. In 1976, having exhausted all of her requests for appeal on the grounds of trial irregularities, she began serving a 15 to 25-year sentence. There was no movement that came up to support her. There was no popular outcry. There weren't teachings and rallies. Nobody saw this as something that the left should get involved in. In Maryland that same year, 1973, after 17 years of abuse, a wife named Barbara Jean Gilbert killed her husband. She was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Again, she also lacked movement support, but she nonetheless appealed her conviction and was granted a new trial. She was then convicted of manslaughter. In her case, the prosecuting attorney actually did not ask for a prison sentence, and the parole and probation board recommended that she get probation instead of jail time. But the judge sentenced Gilbert to 8 years, which was the maximum penalty for manslaughter. And what he said during sentencing was, "You have inflicted pain and deprivation. You have snuffed out a life. Therefore, the court has the right to inflict pain and deprivation on you." And again, there was no mass movement that emerged to draw attention to her case or to provide better legal assistance. And this reflected a growing silence among the more radical movements around the issues of abuse and battering, particularly in families and among intimates. However, it's not as if the issues of abuse and battering weren't becoming more widely publicized during that time. In 1977, a study from Chicago's Cook County Jail was widely reported in all sorts of mainstream newspapers. It had found that 40% of the women in Cook County Jail charged with murdering their partners had been physically attacked repeatedly by these men. So they weren't necessarily just deciding one day to wake up and kill their husbands, but they were responding to the fact that they were repeatedly being assaulted and abused, and they felt that there was no other escape. This same study showed that each of these women had called the police at least 5 times and that many had already separated from these men in attempts to escape the abuse. Again, however, no mass movements emerged to support these women or other battered women. And there was an idea that battered women are somehow at fault for choosing partners that abuse them and staying and or not escaping this abuse. And this idea continues to persist today if we sort of look at, you know, the ideas around domestic violence. However, towards the end of the 1970s, there were some in the women's movement who recognized the need to support battered women, and more resources were created for battered women. And by 1982, the number of battered women's shelters was estimated to be between 300 to 700. However, this did not decrease the number of men killing their female partners. It did decrease the number of women killing their male partners by more than 25%. So it gave women more of an opportunity to escape, but it didn't challenge, these resources didn't challenge the notion that men had the right to abuse their female partners, that men had the right to abuse and or kill their women. Some of this attention and this organizing also resulted in a watering down of the analysis around battering because there wasn't necessarily this challenging the idea that women were this property that could be abused. And Susan Jordan's groundbreaking argument in the Inez Garcia case became the battered women syndrome, which said that women somehow learned to be helpless because of repeated abuse. And this argument actually left out women who didn't fit stereotypical ideals of what submissive, domestic, and feminine wives and mothers should be. So anyone who is poor or black or loud or, you know, fill in any of these notions that aren't June Cleaver-esque, were left out of this syndrome. And this was demonstrated in 1979 in the trials of two women, two separate trials of women, Beverly Ibn Tamas and Kathy Thomas, both of whom were black women who had killed their batterers. But the trial courts actually refused to admit testimony on battered women's syndrome. Thomas was further stigmatized because she was a welfare recipient and occasional drug user, and both women were convicted of murder and sentenced to extremely long sentences. So you can see that this idea of battered women's syndrome somehow got twisted to uphold patriarchal ideas of, you know, femininity and who was sort of a deserving woman, and also upheld ideas of race and class and who was deserving and not deserving of leniency. Also, with the watering down of this analysis around battering, there's a shift in focus towards relying on the state to deal with abuse rather than in communities dealing with abuse and trying to challenge this patriarchal idea that men could beat women. And there was a shift towards looking at mandatory arrest and mandatory sentencing to punish abusers, which, again, didn't necessarily decrease the amount of abuse that women and children were suffering. Many women of color and radical feminists questioned this shift within the battered women's movement and argued that this targeted poor people and communities of color more than it did middle-class white households. And many of these women left the larger and more mainstream battered women's movement to form their own groups. At the same time, many non-women-centered radical movements weren't addressing the idea of battering or abuse at all, so there wasn't necessarily a counterpoint to this idea that the more mainstream liberal women's movement was positing, that men who beat women should just be arrested and that would take care of it, without challenging underlying ideas. And in the meantime, the non-women-centered movements were just saying, like, well, we're not dealing with this. This is a personal problem. And so what we can learn from these examples is that we can see that even in 2011, if we're not addressing the fact that we live in a society that condones gendered violence, and if we're not coming up with these solutions to address this, then basically the fallback becomes relying on prisons and policing to keep women and other vulnerable people safe. And we can also see that it's imperative to support women who are incarcerated for killing their abusers, as well as supporting women who are being abused on the outside before they have to take that step, especially in our own communities, because abuse isolates people. Like, if you think back to, like, you know, like, if you think about what abuse is, you know, one of the key tactics of abuse is isolating that person from any sort of support network and support network that could help her escape. And we should see that gendered violence and the prison system are connected, and we should be working on both fronts to end violence against women without strengthening government control over women's lives and over the rest of our lives as well, and without promoting incarceration as a solution to social problems. Thanks.
Thanks, Vicki. I'm really happy to have Vicki Long come all the way from New York to lay down this knowledge for us. And I'm really happy to see so many new faces here that haven't been at other events, which means I can recycle all of my old jokes for you. So, why is it important to look at the 1970s? Why is it important to look at history? I was 7 in 77, so I missed a lot of this. The only war that I was worried about had Chewbacca and Darth Vader in it. So, why is it important for those of us who want to change the world today to look back at these histories? These histories are really important because they shape our understanding of what's actually possible, right? How, what, you know, what types of human behavior, what types of human solidarities are actually possible. My article in here is called Rising Up, Poor White Angry in the New Left, and it got started over about 10 years ago when I was smoking pot on the top of Vernal Hill with a guy named Malik Rahim, who's a former Black Panther from the New Orleans chapter. And he said, you know, I used to hate white people. And I was like, well, you know, obviously since we've been working hand in hand, organizing together for the past 2 years, you changed your mind at some point. What happened? He goes, well, back in the 60s, I went to a Panther convention, and there's this group of really crazy white kids that had the Confederate flag on their uniforms, you know, but they were running armed security for Fred Hampton. So I figured if there was hope for those guys, there was hope for the rest of them. So I started researching the Young Patriots organization and very quickly got in touch with my now good friend Steve Tappas and other folks, and found out that there were other groups that weren't, it wasn't just the Young Patriots organization and their questionable choice of emblems, which is still extremely questionable to this day. But there are groups like Rising Up Angry, who organized people that we see as greasers, you know, in popular culture in Chicago. They started off at that point and then moved on and evolved to add in a women's project and a GI project. October 4th organization out of Philadelphia, you know, they were organizing in white working class communities in Philadelphia, and scored really one of the, you know, in coalition with many other groups, really scored one of the biggest anti-racist urban victories, which is defeating Frank Rizzo, the racist mayor, never denying him a third term, doing lots of other innovative stuff. White Lightning out of the South Bronx, which were, you know, ex-dope fiends, and they were an integrated group of junkies at the time. They most of them were actually still alive, and they were kind of like the disinfection of a drug program that got politicized and started demanding their rights and working hand in hand with the young lords. So this kind of hidden tendency, I don't know if it was ever large enough to call it a tendency or whatnot, was an example of very poor white people and working class white people being very, very inspired by the Black Power catalyst, amongst other things, and say, well, if that's happening in these communities, why can't it happen here? And as we on the left sometimes can spend hours and hours dissecting race and class and gender till its last microbe, there's a very clear understanding in most of the groups and most of the people that I interviewed with my co-author Amy Soni, is that solidarity and anti-racism, I don't think anybody even used that term at the time, was absolutely important, but also standing up for your rights as a working class person were absolutely essential. It wasn't just doing something for somebody else, but this was also in your self-interest. So the types of work that these groups did looked a lot like remixes of the Black Panther serve the people model. People found ways to directly serve the communities that they were rooted in, but do so in a way that was very smart, that would actually engender solidarity. So Rising Up Angry, one of the most touching stories of Rising Up Angry, actually picking a landlord to go after who had properties, slum properties in Black, white, and Puerto Rican neighborhoods, right? Because that would actually mean that you had to team up with people in those those neighborhoods, and that was very, very intelligent, very basic, but very strategic choice. October 4th organization did anti-police brutality work because, as anybody who's ever been in Philly knows, that there was a little bit of a police brutality problem there, and it was even more acute under Frank Rizzo at the time. And they would just go out and talk to white kids about what was going on with police brutality in their lives, and then say, hey, by the way, we're holding a meeting. We're coming together with the Panthers. We're coming together with the Puerto Ricans, and we're going to try to figure out how to solve this problem together. And they got lots of pushback. So it goes back. We always hear the term Rainbow Coalition as it was something that fell out of Jesse Jackson's brain, but really the original Rainbow Coalition was a formal coalition between the Young Patriots Party, the Young Lords, and the Black Panthers in Chicago, and grew to embrace, lowercase rainbow coalitions, which were the model of organizing your own but walking together in coalition. And it was both formal and informal, and it expanded to many other groups in Chicago. People tried to replicate the model all over the place, but we also see that when rainbow politics, which the great Black Panther Bob Lee told me was basically a code word for class politics, or reintroducing class politics into the mix in an era that had been highly racialized. The Rainbow Coalitions, when they really started getting started, both formally and informally, that was when we really saw COINTELPRO start with the absolute violence. It was against like really step up. It's not like it was they invented it just for the Rainbow Coalition, but when you saw these groups starting to get together, it was really when there was a high price to be paid. The original Rainbow Coalition was announced in June of 69. Manuel Ramos from the Young Lords was executed in the streets of Chicago shortly thereafter, and by the end of the year, Fred Hampton was assassinated, in the story that probably most of us know really well. So what can we learn from this? First of all, is that mass media and the stereotypes of poor whites as being automatically reactionary, I think we can go through it. The Beverly Hillbillies, Staying Alive, the John Travolta stereotype of working class Italians, you know, about as far away from Sacco and Benzetti as you can get. What are other media portrayals of poor whites that have shaped our news? Anybody want to throw one out?
Little Abner.
Little Abner.
Archie Bunker.
What's that?
Archie Bunker.
Archie Bunker. Yeah, Archie. All of these different portrayals basically shaped people's political expectations of that. Certainly, the work of Rising Up Angry, the work of White Lightning, never made the front page of the newspaper or never was ever broadcast. But every single time poor whites acted in racist, violent ways during the civil rights era, that was broadcast over and over again. But these projects prove that there's no such thing as determinism, right? We are living in a time, in a very populist time in the United States, just, you know, not exactly like we were in the 60s or certainly not in the 30s, but we're living in populist times where economic conditions that have gotten so bad that it was basically a split. People go left, right, and center all over the place. I grew up in the oh-so-liberal town of Vallejo, right up the street. I remember when the factory started to shut down. It wasn't the left that was there to outreach to working-class whites who had had a good union card, who had had the cabin, who had had the vote, through union membership. It was white Aryan resistance. For those of you who are from the Bay Area may remember the Aryan Woodstock. And then it was groups like Prairie Fire and the International Socialist Organization that were trailing, right? That were actually trailing the racists and trying to convince people in Vallejo, who to blame, because everybody knew that it was globalization that was taking our jobs. But who are you going to blame for that? Were you going to blame the people that were signing the trade agreements, or the people who were cleaning up the table after the trade agreements were signed? So these groups have been extremely inspiring to me as far as just making me reimagine what's actually possible. I don't think that any groups, that anybody in here is, that you should basically take as a blueprint or copy them for social change, but certainly this is a really good place to learn from people's victories and their defeats. Other groups like Sojourner Truth Organization that are chronicled here, Movement for a New Society, American Indian Movement. It's really important because this is not ancient history. This has happened when most of us in this room were kids or just slightly older. So anyhow, I'll just pass it on to Roxanne, and I hope you'll buy the book, because if you don't buy the books, they don't get made the next time.
Well, it's good to be here in Berkeley City College. How many of you are Berkeley City College students? Oh, good. Thank you for your school using it. I really have to hand it to Dan Berger. Unlike most anthologies on the 60s or movements or the present or anything else, there's rarely ever an inclusion of Native American, except in rhetoric, and sort of naming the oppressed groups, but no in-depth. And he actually solicited three in-depth pieces. One he co-wrote with me, which also included, it's on land, it's chapter 3, on struggle for the land. And it's the American Indian Movement, the Republic of New Africa, and the Hispano land-grant movement in New Mexico. And so that's really pretty amazing. I also there are so many good articles in this book. We're just a representation of three of them. So I hope you'll buy it and read all of them, because they really do give us some pointers, you know, where we come from and where we're going and how we should assess the present in terms of, at that time everything was falling apart as well as these things going on that persisted. And of course the women's movement, the gay movement, the Native American movement, I think have, you know, been a continuum that are very important. And there's a lot in here about those beginnings. The chapter, let me just read the introduction to chapter 6 is how indigenous peoples wound up in the United Nations. You may not even know that indigenous peoples have been working in the United Nations since the 70s to build an international law for the protection of indigenous peoples. Let me just read you this one little paragraph. The period bookended between the U.S. constitutional crisis generated by Richard Nixon's re-election in 1972 and Ronald Reagan's accession to office in 1981 was historic for indigenous peoples in the United States and throughout the Americas. The 1960s had ushered in a new direction in the indigenous struggles for land and self-determination throughout the country and the continent. Following decades of bare survival, of petitioning Congress, filing court cases, and attempting to work with federal government programs, a focus on indigenous sovereignty went from aspiration to formulation. Then came harsh repression under the infamous FBI counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. This operation that nearly crushed the indigenous movement in the United States and did crush the Black Panther Party, for instance, and many other movements that were in effect. The indigenous movement was saved largely by its decision, very conscious decision, after Wounded Knee, when the real, you know, repression came down. A conscious decision was made to embrace, insist on, and apply international human rights law. The story of how that came about is the subject of this essay, which is based on my own participation in the UN work and my position as a historian of Native American history. So I want to, I think some of you know about the American Indian Movement and how it started in 1968 and the next year, the seizure of Alcatraz. It started in Minnesota. There was the background was that there was a new attack upon Native Americans during the McCarthy period, during the 1950s. It was not the first time, but once again decided that Native American collectivity and commons, being the reservations, was too akin to communism and should be done away with. This was done in the 1880s and 90s with allotment, first of all. And that was devastating. About three-fourths of the Indian land base was lost through allotting into small parts. But fortunately, it was stopped with the New Deal. The Indian New Deal was to stop allotment and to really impose the Indian Reorganization Act, which did recognize tribal governments and sovereignty. So 15 years after that, in the 1950s, there was a Termination Act. They literally called it the Termination Act to terminate Native Americans as Indians. They should just become random people, individuals. And so they started terminating reservations to destroy them. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to implement this congressional legislation, developed the Indian Relocation Program. As they knew Indians were not going to leave on their own, so they used this kind of push-pull factor, withdrawing federal funds, which are really trust funds of Native Americans for reparations from land taken. It's not taxpayer money. Nevertheless, the government controls it. So they, they developed programs in designated cities. The Bay Area was one, Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose. The electronics industry was getting started, and that particular was a training program. They had Denver, Phoenix, Chicago, Cleveland, Dallas, of all places. And they just, pushed people to leave the reservation. There were no jobs. People were having to commute and work anyway. So for young people especially, it was very, a one-way ticket to the big city and supposedly job training and 3 months of housing sounded good. But, of course, the Indians ended up in the poorest districts, usually the Latino neighborhoods, sometimes out here the Samoan neighborhoods that were already established, and fell in, after those 3 months of training, there usually were no jobs available. It was very poor training, not transferable. It wasn't like carpentry or plumbing or, something solid. It was just very low-paid assembly line work. So then there was a burgeoning movement in the reservations to stop termination. And so you started having land seizures and these things. The best known, of course, is when it comes to Alcatraz. It got world attention, but there have been hundreds of them. Fish ends up in the Northwest to establish fishing rights. And a good court decision that was won. And so Native Americans really mobilized in the 50s and some very good organizations. And in a way, the American Indian Movement was an end product, not a beginning of that organizing. They were the second generation that came in. They were much more militant, as were the times. They had watched for a year, the Black Panthers with their guns and their berets and their black outfits, so they put on red outfits and started patrolling urban areas like in Minneapolis, where AIM was born. Some of them were working with Indian centers. Some had already been in the cities because a lot of Native Americans migrated for jobs during the war to places like L.A. and the Bay Area to work in the shipyards and stayed, like the famous Means family, Russell Means and Bill Means and those five brothers that became important leaders of the American Indian Movement. It's funny for you Italians. They pretended to be Italian, and so no one would think they were Native American. And Russell Means taught the tango and Arthur Murray dance club.
A lot of Italians now pretend like they're Native Americans.
I know.
116th.
So it was a mixed bunch, but they were militant, and the militant ideas that were churning in the whole movement, of course, they weren't isolated from that. So the land, but how they translated like sit-ins of the civil rights movements, looking for ways to express this. They had nothing to sit in, so they seized land. They seized Alcatraz. That was their sit-in. They seized Wounded Knee. They seized many, many places. They put toll roads through the reservation, made people stop and pay tolls who weren't from there on state highways. And most of this stuff was definitely against the law. And it just as the civil rights movement city at that time in the southern states, it was against the law for blacks to sit at a Woolworths counter with whites. So it's breaking the law, but it was nonviolent. At Wounded Knee, it was also nonviolent. But the Nixon administration, 1973, right at the beginning, I think he really wanted to create a smokescreen, kind of like killing bin Laden, to create a smokescreen for other problems that he was having. And so he, sent in the 82nd Airborne and sent in the Army. It was just like, it was literally like Wounded Knee. I mean, like Vietnam, which was going on. In fact, most of the Native American leaders at Wounded Knee were Vietnam vets, recently returned infantry. And it was like, okay, the helicopters ahead, above, you know, it was familiar. They weren't armed. They took over a little store, you know, trading post that had some hunting rifles, single-shot 22s. One famous picture of an AK-47 was a souvenir that one of the Vietnam vets brought back and had no ammunition for. So it really was not, it was portrayed as a very violent act, but it was not. There were very elder people there as the mainstay. Well, I think the solidity, you know, then after that, when it was a terrible repression, people were rounded up. They negotiated to come out and there would be a complete, it was sort of like Attica. They promised them that they would, there would be no reprisals for, you know, any damage and no arrest, but what they did immediately when they came out was arrest everyone. And so everyone was put into trials, and then the COINTELPRO, and over 300 local AIM people were killed. The locals, they had gotten burrowed very deep in every part of the country. Small reservations, large ones, urban areas, chapters everywhere. And the elders said, you know, it's a little more complicated than this, but they said, you know, it's time to stop dealing with the United States and act on our sovereignty and go to the United Nations and be recognized. And this was not the first time. The Chief de Skaya of the Iroquois had gone to the League of Nations in 1923 and stayed in Geneva for 7 years. When we went back there, it was every Swiss school child knows about de Skaya. So it was like this return of the native people to Geneva, to the UN. So they decided, they had a meeting a year after Wounded Knee, a year and 2 or 3 months, June of 1974, and formed the International Indian Treaty Council. And that's how I got roped into, you know, during Wounded Knee and then afterwards to do. There were very few of us with any kind of college degrees or, you know, professionals and lawyers and all. So we all got tapped to somehow figure out. The elders say, you know, you've got to go get recognition at the UN. You figure out how to do it. And there's no money for it. So that's your task. And that's how it worked. And I always say, you know, I wrote an essay called How Did Evo Morales Become President of Bolivia, Not Just a Genetic Native Person, you know, DNA, but on the shoulders of a mass Native movement of Amaray people. His parents were involved in this international indigenous movement in the 70s. You know, so many things. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible, the kind of links and this network and maze. And this was before the internet. Internet has helped a lot to facilitate even more of that. But it all started without any of that kind of technology, the networking and getting people to the UN. Well, I want to end with just four things that I think were unique about the Native movement that is important to understand for organizing this country, you know, for revolution, basically, for everyone. One is that it was from the beginning and from the culture itself. In some cases, this has to be developed artificially. If it's not there, it's intergenerational. And I don't mean just the presence of different people, but the elders' councils, you know, and the women's leadership. And there was no fondness. I think I usually lied about being, you know, involved in the women's liberation movement because people really didn't like that idea, that word, you know, that meant something. But women's leadership in particular, because most of these societies are matrilineal, matriarchal, And so it's just a natural thing, but it was also seen as odd if, you know, the women were not there or involved. And I, by intergenerational, I mean too that in a room like this, an India meeting, the oldest people imaginable down to babies. And it would be very odd to have any kind of meeting. It's still always odd to me where that wouldn't be the case, any kind of movement, activity or meeting, that everyone wouldn't be in the same place. So the little children are getting infused with this, you know, movement from the time they're born. So AIM was very controversial among Indians. Obviously, any radical group is. But it also moved by intergenerational. There were older people who had really tried to do things, you know, by the law and with the government. It pushed those people to more radical positions when AIM took stands, like at Wounded Knee, the National Tribal Chairman's Association that Nixon had made up and was, you know, paying them a lot, you know, just to keep things down. They actually came around and supported Wounded Knee and spoke out against the repression, and they got their funding taken away and disappeared as an organization. But that, because it was intergenerational, it wasn't just what they could call a bunch of young thugs, you know, or violent young men or something. They couldn't do that. The press tried to, but Native Americans knew better. The second is that it was international. And I don't mean just, you know, this global thing or World Social Forum thing. I mean international in terms of moving the international institutions to radical positions. At the time that we were doing this, we learned this from the National Liberation Movements. That's what they were doing, and the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, the African National Congress, SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, the PLO. They were moving the UN. And we went in, and, you know, I really think we have a base in there of that is really important for others to get involved in. And they did for Durban in 2001, the peoples of African descent in the diaspora are still involved, but they came in with, you know, with Durban, the immigration rights, but still, you know, the movements, the social movements, the labor movements, for instance, where they have a handmade institution, the International Labor Organization. They don't participate. So the international, and it, not just solidarity with national liberation movements, which American Indian Movement did, but similar goals of self-determination of nations and peoples. The American Indian Movement got very involved with the Sandinistas and had known many of them here in San Francisco, the Nicaraguans, and participated in you know, in opposing the Contra War and there. So other people did that too, but I think they didn't, you know, they were going to help, but not really going to see what they could learn to apply here. It's a kind of arrogance, and the Native Americans wanted to learn. Here's, you know, what they considered a bunch of Indians, the Nicaraguans, that they had won a revolution, you know, so there was something to learn from them. The third is when government cracked down with COINTELPRO, the American Indian Movement morphed into an international organization which still exists. AIM exists, and AIM West is really getting developed here in the Bay Area, mainly by Tony Gonzalez's hard work. But International Indian Treaty Council is the real essence of AIM being carried on. Building ties with other indigenous peoples movements in Latin America and the Pacific, and then, you know, in the Arctic, the Nordic, the Sami and the Nordic part of the world. And seeking redress and a place at the United Nations. And the fourth is that they remain strongly and absolutely based in the local communities, in the indigenous communities, and with the people. So this constant interchange and back and forth and feeding and bringing the information back. It's not just staying somewhere, you know, an elite group of people. In fact, there's no delegation that goes to the UN without this, you know, this combination of elders to babies. And that was a little hard for, you know, the stiff-necked UN people to accept, but now they've gotten used to it. Those are my main points, and any questions you have are fine. But I want to mention before I forget that this month's monthly review has a piece I wish were really in this book, because there's nothing about labor, and it's called Labor Revolts in the 1970s by this wonderful woman, L.A. Leary, who was United Auto Workers. But it was, they were really trying to make it more militant. So since I'm the last one, this might be a good time for Larissa to...
That would be great.
Can she... Can? Oh, thanks. Make your announcement, Larissa.
If we have any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Okay. I had an announcement, but I also had a question.
Okay.
An announcement, thank you so much for the intro. Hi, I'm Larissa Mann. I'm a member of Academic Workers for a Democratic Union, which is a reform movement within UAW 2865, which is the union which has organized graduate students at UC Berkeley. We have been occupying the union office, which is around the corner at 27 Austin Way, for the past 3 days because we've been running a reform slate, which had a good chance of winning in the statewide election. When it looked like it had a good chance of winning, the incumbents stopped counting the votes and ran away. So we started occupying both union offices down in UCLA, where they were counting votes, and up here. Yesterday, the UAW leadership backed down and said they would start counting the votes, which was very exciting. But they haven't yet started. And, of course, there's other ways that this struggle could continue to go. So I wanted to encourage anyone who wants to come by and say hello. We're in the union office 24/7. Again, it's 27 the Alston Way, literally a block away from the other side of here. We'd love for people to come by and to learn, also to learn from people who've been involved. One of the great things about the intergenerational story is a lot of us parents were labor organizers, and parents have been coming through.
That's
and
great.
Other folks. And we learned a lot, and we want to learn more. And we also just issued a statement in solidarity with the occupation at Glen Cove of Indigenous peoples, who right now are often occupying there for 19 days because it's a sacred site with a burial ground, and the Parks Department wants to renovate it and put in a bunch of public toilets over it. Great. I mean, the whole thing is horrific. We're happy to try to find these moments to have solidarity and also to learn from other struggles. So people could come by for that. So that's my announcement. Thank you. And I did have a question totally different from that, and it's really idiosyncratic because this is the stuff I nerd out about. But it's mostly for Roxanne and James just because of the broader story, not so much about legal battles. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts from what you've studied or what you've participated in about the role of social spaces in building these coalitions across different groups of people, like, because I'm a DJ and I do music and stuff, I'm always interested in, like, how people socialize and how that can build solidarity across different interests as well as within sort of groups themselves. And I wonder if you have any thoughts or memories or stories about how recreation and entertainment and music and those kind of things that aren't often seen as political, they don't have to be fight songs, but, like, just social moments, if those have played any role in the struggles that you guys have been a part of.
Well, with the what's with the Native American, you know, I've had several movement lives, but in the women's movement, one thing we, you know, because we were ridiculed so much in 68 when we really came out in the open, the militant women's liberation movement in 1968, we started using home spaces a lot more, turning homes into social spaces. And it was interesting because especially, you know, in Boston working mainly with working class women and also sex workers and welfare rights women and factory workers and all that, they, you know, their social space was pretty privatized in the home, and it really changed the dynamics. It didn't make husbands very happy, and there were a lot of separations. And anyway, that I think is something we should think about as it gets harder and harder to have, you know, public social spaces that we have our homes as obvious places where people can gather. With the Native American movement, the space was almost always outside, you know, having long, you know, camping out and having meetings and having everyone there. And the whole reservation, you know, every reservation, whether New Mexico or Arizona or South Dakota or Nevada, was a social space if you were, you know, if the arrangements were made to be invited. And these, like the International Indian Treaty Council meetings, are sometimes, you know, like 5,000 people camping out for 2 weeks and having meetings and, you know, just cooking together and everything. And I know people do retreats and things now, but it seems so artificial because it's not like just ordinary people, you know. It's like a retreat to discuss, you know, what you're going to do for the next year or something. And not really, I mean, we would hammer out our, every time we go to the UN, and still this is the case, have, you know, one of these gatherings and collectively decide what was going to be presented, who's going to speak, and everything by consensus, no voting. And, you know, that I think takes a long time. You have to take time and space, have the space and the time, but I think we should think about that more, you know, of having longer, you know, elongated. And since there's so much unemployment now, there may be more time, you know, for people to do that.
Actually, Vicki is a core member of one of the United States' biggest social space, longest-running dissident social spaces, ABC New Rio, in New York City. So she can definitely answer this question better than I can, but I'll just say that when I started organizing, it was possible to live in the Bay Area, work part-time, right? You know, pull your resources with people who cared about something that you did and create, and try to create a movement with it, right? You know, you could go to school part-time, work part-time, and resist, we built the Eviction Defense Network in an office that was like $125 a month rent, and we just pulled it with other people, like-minded people that had these little projects. You don't have that anymore. I mean, so it's directly tied to the gentrification, displacement, and social exclusion in cities, that we don't have these things anymore. We don't have these opportunities to really think big.
Well, social spaces, like I'm involved with ABC No Rio, and for me, having that as a social space was key to my development as, you know, somebody who became political and became a prison abolitionist and became a writer and became a photographer, because before that, I was a teenage delinquent. So, you know, like having that social space to actually go and you could be smart, but you could also be kind of like, I don't want to go to law school or medical school or any of the things that Asian parents want their smart children to do. And like, you know, like having that space to find yourself and also talk to people and have people be like, hey, you know, I'm reading this book. It's really interesting. Here's, you know, like a film, you know, that I'm watching. You know, do you want to go see it? Just having that kind of social space was crucial for me, like, you know, like in the direction that I took. And I mean, it's not something that I think that we necessarily talk about when we talk about social spaces in terms of just having that kind of safe space where people can figure out what they want to be doing without these pressures. And it seems like with this increasing like idea that like spaces have to like have a specific purpose or they're only for this, that, or the other, you know, I'm not seeing that as much with some of the other spaces, you know, like that I've gone to or been to where it's like a very specific purpose. Like you come here for a lecture, but like you don't come and you like sit around and like somebody's like, hey, what's that you're reading? Or, you know, what are you doing? Or like, hey, we're going over to this place over here. Like when I was in Barcelona a couple of years ago, and I saw that they were like, they have 300 squatted social centers and social spaces mm-hmm. where people can go and they can like get information, and maybe you could like get some food or some like, you know, like beer or coffee or tea, but like people can exchange ideas and, you know, like, and figure new stuff out, as well as like, you know, kind of just figure out what they want to do. And I think that's crucial for like building movements. It's just having these spaces where people can kind of come together and exchange ideas.
We have a question here. This might be a huge question, but I just wondered what thoughts you might have about why, you know, so much of the world's women are living under such oppressive conditions. Why do you think, maybe from your work, you might theorize why, or what would move women to liberate themselves out of these situations? I mean, most of the world has women who are living in extremely oppressed. Is it because of family? And, you know, I have my own ideas about why this is, but I just was thinking. Might be interesting to talk about.
Vicky,
do you
want to
start?
Start. Well, Sonia knows me. probably knows my ideas, but you know, I think I don't know. I just saw this, you know, this mixtape movie about Black Power last night, so I had like. Time for women to pick up the gun. That's how I feel. No, it's time for women to learn to fight, you know, to protect ourselves. And back in 68, we formed a Taekwondo program, you know, for training ourselves and then training all women classes. Oh, man, we talk this patriarchal Korean guy into allowing us to do this and not pay him anything. And for him not to even be there, you know, present. I'm not sure he could do that. But I really don't know how we succeeded in doing that. But we trained hundreds and hundreds of women. You know, we did patrols in the streets where women, well, in the little factories, it was always dark down by the river in Cambridge, Cambridgeport, where they had all these assembly plants that women worked at, and they would come out. It was, you know, come September, it's dark at 5 o'clock, you know, and they would get, you know, just get stopped and raped and beaten, and so it really worked. But you know, and it was picked up on. I think it spread, and it's sort of. I mean, it's hard to even tell women, you know, when you're out on the street, you really shouldn't carry a little dangling purse and wear high-heeled shoes, you know, unless you really know how to kick them off fast to run, you know. And we train, wear them inside, you know, wear them somewhere, but don't walk down the street at night, you know, with high-heeled shoes on. Just have some smarts, you know. And I don't know, it's kind of... some of this, what I consider kind of middle class, where I grew up, you know, with a little tougher background, being rural, you know, and the women doing what the men did and everything. But I think this middle class mentality is seeped down into everywhere, you know, into all classes, re-feminizing women in ways that are very intentional. And I think doesn't give, you know, the kind of self-confidence of, you know, just being able to be free and take the streets and be there. So I guess, you know, it worked then. I don't know why it wouldn't now. Our problem with anything, I think we can come up with good ideas, but we just have such a problem with organizing to the point that people are organizing themselves. You know, it's like cannibalism. The organizers are organizing each other, you know, training them in something new, and they just keep recycling each other, you know, and then maybe a few new ones come in, and it gets very ingrown, you know, and then no one knows what they're about, you know, and where they are, you know, and so we've lost the knack of organizing and knocking on people's doors and, you know, asking to come in. We had James has this idea about people learning emergency care. You know, we're headed toward apocalypse, not May 21st, but, you know, in general. And we have earthquakes, we saw from the Fukuyama, that we learn skills where we can actually go in communities and help people, you know, be a presence and do something useful instead of just talking.
I'm also thinking, though, about, you know, women in the Muslim world and most of Africa, you know, extremely oppressed conditions.
Well, I'm not going to speak about women in the Muslim world or in Africa because I don't have a field of study or connection there. But I mean, I think even just looking in the U.S., you know, even today in 2011, you know, there's still this normalization of abuse and oppression. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in the 80s and 90s. So, like, you know, this is after the battered women's movement has, like, taken root, you know, like in, like, the more mainstream and people are talking about abuse. And on my block, every single household had abuse. You know, my dad abused my mom. The neighbors across the street, you know, like, had a lot of violence. The neighbors down the block. And this was a normal thing. And this is what I grew up thinking, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s. And it wasn't until, you know, like, I was out of high school that I was like, oh, wait. I guess my boyfriend really shouldn't hit me, even if he doesn't leave bruises. Like, this is how ingrained we are in thinking that it is okay for certain people to be abused. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like all of my friends growing up, like, you know, like, we're like, oh, well, he didn't hit you that hard. You don't have a bruise. It's okay. And that was what was normal. You know, and so you kind of, like, extrapolate that into, like, the rest of society. And, you know, like, and when I grew up, there was also a case which maybe doesn't resonate so much in California, but in New York, there was a case of a middle-class white lawyer named Joel Steinberg that beat his daughter, his foster daughter, to death. And it made the newspapers, it made the headlines, you know, and I think I was, like, maybe 7 or 8. I was old enough to be able to read the newspaper and, like, look at pictures and be like, oh, this is going on. And that kind of thing did not deter a single person that I knew who was, like, you know, involved in some sort of abusive relationship. Because it's just normal. Like, oh, you belong to me. It is okay for me to exert power over you. How do I exert power over you? Well, in a lot of cases, you know, it means that I can physically put my hands on you. You know, I can physically hurt you. And there's a normalization of that. So I think the first step is, like, you know, sort of breaking out of this idea that this is normal and this is acceptable and that, you know, like, people have the right to hurt each other, you know, and oppress each other and kind of take it from there.
I would say, I just add too that, you know, I'm working in the UN all these years since we started with the Decade to Combat Racism in 1974. But in 1973, the first decade for women also started. And we're now, in, you know, decades down the line. So they've been kind of parallel, the decade against racism and against and for women's rights. These women, it takes time, but there are a part of what we're calling the Arab Spring. You probably notice the presence of so many young women in Egypt and Tunisia. And I have a friend, Margaret Randall, who's over in Tunis right now, and she's so thrilled. She's a very strong feminist, and she's so thrilled with the young women. So I think, you know, the UN process, that's another reason why it's important to pay attention to, because it allows in a structural way and in a, you might say, well, it's governments, you know, approved ways that you know, non-governmental organizations especially can push it in different directions. That I know among indigenous women, when we first started, this kind of abuse was so, the women didn't come, and it was their actually situations where the UN fellowships and fundings would not fund a group that came without half women, you know. And so now it's natural, women are predominant in the indigenous But that was not true in the beginning. I would often be the only woman present, you know, and except the very elder women. You know, most men can, they don't have such a problem with elder women. It's the women that they control, you know, or want to control that they have problems with being equal and present. But I think it is happening, but I don't think we contribute much in the United States, our social movements, to some of these constructive things, because we believe the propaganda, you know, and it doesn't make any difference, and it really does, you know, and I've seen it work, and I've seen that. I was in Beijing, you know, when 100,000 women were there from all over the world, and I've seen the transformations. I'll never forget the Chinese put on incredible, you know, acrobatic shows and all this stuff. But my favorite one was they had these tiny kids, or it must have been 4 or 5 years old, about 50 little girls and 50 little boys. And they came out, they were going to demonstrate, they start taking karate or self-defense, hardcore self-defense, when they're 2 years old. And the girls, too. And so they had this, the boys start beating up on the girls, and then the girls just slammed all the boys down. And it was just amazing. And this woman from Tanzania next to me, she yelled out, she says, "I'm going to introduce this into the schools of Tanzania." You know? And so, you know, those things do have an effect, and you don't see it happening, but it is, and it's underneath when you see it explode, like in Egypt and Tunisia, and in Bahrain and Yemen, where it's being, you know, suppressed. The women are there also, you know, noticeably not in Libya, but that's another thing.
Thank you to all of you again for coming here tonight, and please, under, if you have any other questions, I'm sure anyone would be more, any of our participants would be more than happy to talk with you about it, but and on your way out, you can purchase a book.
Can't we have to, a couple more? Some more questions? I thought we were going to nine.
Yes.
I think all three of you touched on it, if not directly and more implicitly, the idea of solidarity. And I'm starting to realize more and more that that is such an ambiguous idea, as well as practice, and it's often problematic in terms of how it's used, whether it's ignoring your own stuff or being that as your identity, being solidarity with other people. So I was wondering if anybody wanted to unpack that idea, both in as an idea as well as practice.
It's something that I could probably go on about 2 hours in a bad rant about, so I'll try to do it in 90 seconds. Solidarity, obviously, is the lifeblood of peoples. However, it can be very misused, as you alluded to. I think that sometimes solidarity is used in, we have solidarity with somebody else somewhat locked up somewhere. We have solidarity with people across the globe, but we don't ever look have solidarity with people that are walking around in our own communities. We don't have solidarity with our own community members. And so I think that it's all solidarity starts at home, starts with building a good practice and knowing why you're in it, right? Whether you're working class, whether you're dirt poor, whether you're middle class, knowing why you're in the game and knowing why you're there, because anybody that you claim to have solidarity with is going to want to know the answer to that question of why are you here? It's the most basic thing. I remember when, when Mumia was the talk of the town, you know, you had people that that would actually go to Mumia marches here in San Francisco, and were some of the same characters that we actually had to go fight around evictions, right? You know, that were actually part of very prominent leftist organizations. So like, it's fine solidarity with everybody else, but I'm going to buy this house and I'm going to kick your grandma out and fuck you, right? Because of entitlement. So starting locally and getting it before you move on to Mumia, or whether you move on to Libya or wherever you're going to have solidarity with everything. I think that's the key part.
I was thinking when you were asking that about Chiapas and what people learn from there. I know people think they learn, but I'm not sure they're learning that's a lesson in solidarity right there within. Because that group of people who went, you know, clandestinely to hiding out from the federal police after 68, after the repression of 68 in Mexico, of which Subcomandante Marcos was one, they went there, they basically went there to, or, you know, they were going to organize those Indians, you know, and teach them all about Marxism and everything. And what they did, you know, I mean, they wanted to be in solidarity, and they were pretty sure they could be undetected there because, you know, it was such a neglected place. What they did was get incorporated into the struggles of the Tetzal Mayan themselves. So to me, solidarity is dissolving yourself into something and not being, you know, the other who is organizing. And you have to do that, I think, with just by being there. And we need to be in communities across this country. I work in Oklahoma most of the time. With my organizing, my main organizing projects are there, and it's a tough place if you know the two senators from there, Senator Imhoff and what's the other one's name? I can't even remember, but they are the most reactionary. You know, it has 76 counties, and in the last election, every single congressional district in Oklahoma was a landslide for John McCain. So it's unheard of in history, you know. So it's a tough going there. You can get killed for being, say, gay, openly gay there. And yet gay people are organizing, and you find ways of doing it. But one thing that's really important is that there are several of us from the older generation and some young people who went out and who have gone back there to, you know, to dissolve ourselves and be useful in whatever way we can. And also writing is very important. My book, Red Dirt, is just a handbook, you know, for a lot of the young people there who are working. It gives them there's a real inferiority complex out in the, you know, between the two oceans, about capabilities. There's very little education. And so, of course, just like at one time they were attracted to the Aryan Brotherhood or the Ku Klux Klan, it's now, you know, now it's the Tea Party. And it's something they go for, you know. They've been organized by Tea Party very cleverly. So I think that's what I would say solidarity really means, to become a part of something and not be, you know, just writing letters or whatever. I mean, those things are useful too, or using whatever skills you have or whatever you're asked to do. I know Hillary Klein, who's spent so much time down in Chiapas, the first time she went, she said, you know, she has all these skills and everything, and they met and they talked and they said, we want you to go teach the women addition. Addition. I'm not a mathematician. They said, well, you know how to add, you know, four and four, you know how to, yeah, well, of course. You know, she felt so downgraded, you know, she would do something lofty, you know. And she did, because they were actually teaching the women how to budget, you know, their households, just how to budget the household things and learn basic math. I mean, and it's not much different in parts of the United States, you know, of very basic things to do. So I think, basically, I think everyone in urban areas who are displaced should go back to where they came from and organize. And that's solidarity. Except Boston, you don't get to go.
Well, when your question brought up, I work a lot with incarcerated women across the nation. Sorry, I flew in from New York this morning. I'm very tired and I'm about to fall off my chair. But one of the things that I recognize is that, like, I'm working in solidarity with them. I am not incarcerated. I have this, like, privilege of, you know, being able to, like, walk outside. See, you know, like, I have this freedom of movement, even if it's, like, constricted by, like, you know, like, my income or, you know, like, my mobility or whatever. I still have a lot more privilege than somebody who's locked up inside. So for me, working in solidarity means, like, you know, like, talking with them and taking direction from them, but also, you know, like, recognizing that I have these certain privileges, like being outside, you know, being able to have, like, freedom of, like, speech and writing and not necessarily having to deal with all the same repercussions that I would if I were trying to exercise these same things inside, you know, and trying to figure out how to leverage my relative privilege to be able to, like, you know, help them, you know, and, like, get their voices out there and see, like, what they need and how to get those needs met, while at the same time sort of, like, looking at this loftier goal of, you know, like, getting rid of the prison industrial complex altogether. So you're not necessarily like, oh, well, we're just going to keep helping you, kind of like social service providers or, you know, reformers or, you know, like Christian missionary ladies. But, you know, like, being like, okay, we have this loftier goal, like Hillary Klein, you know, like, there's a loftier goal, but sometimes you just do these, like, very basic things that you're like, you know, why do I need to, like, teach addition? Or why do I need to, like, you know, like, do this, like, small little thing that on the surface doesn't seem like this, it's this great revolutionary act. But, you know, like, it kind of all adds up. And it's also recognizing that people have immediate needs here and now, and that, you know, it shouldn't be on us to think that we're beyond that or above, you know, above that kind of work.
Burning or not?
You could also ask some questions on our way over to say hi to the people that are challenging the UAW to be a better union. Yeah.
You can also make a statement.
Just join them. Yeah.
Join
us. You
can. It's okay. Thank you.